You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 20th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the programme, as Poland's hardline government takes on the country's judges, Europe has finally had enough. But will its tough talk achieve anything? Meanwhile, Germany takes Turkey to task over its human rights abuses, but Turkey accuses Germany of double standards. John McCain, one of the leading Republican voices challenging Donald Trump, reveals he has a brain tumour and will be taking a break.
It is our willingness to shape world events for the better that has kept us safe, increased our prosperity, preserved our liberty, and transformed human history.
But who will speak up against the president in his place? Later, we'll hear from the film director telling the story of the Syrians who brought the plight of civilians in Raqqa to the world's attention.
This film is a celebration of individuals, again, risking their lives to expose the truth and to shed light on dark corners of the world. We would have no idea what's happening in Raqqa if it wasn't for these guys.
Plus, a culinary tour of Sao Paulo, and how do you replace a TV legend? A question we'll try to answer in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. So all that to come. First of all, a quick look at some of the day's other top news stories. A UN report is warning that North Korea is facing severe food shortages. It says the country has suffered its worst drought since 2001, devastating crops. The report says that children and the elderly are most at risk without significant imports of food. Around 20 years ago, it's thought that hundreds of thousands of North Koreans died after a widespread famine. The head of the Organization of American States says there has been a catastrophic deterioration of the situation in Venezuela, warning that a nationwide strike could lead to a bloodbath. Previous protests against Nicolas Maduro's government have ended in violence, with almost 100 people killed since the beginning of April. The former U.S. sports star and actor O.J. Simpson is to be released from prison. He was cleared of a double murder in a notorious court case more than 20 years ago, but has served 9 years in a jail in Nevada for armed robbery and assault with a deadly weapon. And the body of the artist Salvador Dali is being exhumed in northeastern Spain tonight to try to settle a paternity suit. The surrealist painter died in 1989, but a woman claims he is her father. Samples from his remains are to be tested against her DNA. Welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. For a while now, the rest of Europe has looked on with increasing alarm at events in Poland, but now it seems the rest of Europe has had enough. The Polish government's move to bring the country's judiciary under its control has led the European Commission to warn that it is very close to triggering action that could suspend Poland's EU voting rights. But would that make any difference? Well, to learn more, I'm joined in the studio now by the EU analyst, Paweł Sedlicki. Paweł, thank you very much for coming in this evening. This is something that's called Article 7, which is this EU nuclear option that's never been used before and is reserved for countries that it said don't respect the common values of the European Union. So what's happened to bring relations with Poland to that sort of level?
Well, this is only the latest in the series of measures taken by the Polish government to effectively bring vast swathes of the public sector, of the non-government public sector, under its control. So the judiciary, the state broadcaster, the constitutional tribunal. And it is for this reason that that the European Commission has said that this, quite rightly in my view, has said that this does not conform with the respecting the rule of law, which is a fundamental value of EU membership and a condition of membership. I think the problem is, however, that Article 7 is very hard to trigger because it requires unanimity. And although many EU member states and indeed across the world there is a lot of concern at what Poland is doing, Hungary and another EU member state has already this evening written to the Polish government to say that it supports what what it is doing, and to say that that it will protect it from what it described as unjustified political interference by the European Commission. So whatever the Commission might say, its room for manoeuvre is limited.
So as you say, because there has to be that unanimity, if Hungary is going to veto it, it can't happen, which just really leaves the rest of the European Union with effectively sort of pressure and shaming. Now, the former president of the European Council is a former Polish prime minister. So what's he been saying about this?
Well, Donald Tusk, who your listeners may or may not remember, the Polish government actually tried to force out of office and failed in that endeavour, because all the other European countries backed his nomination or renomination for the position of European Council president. He has said that this is a very critical situation, and that he stands ready to work with the Polish president, who is now the only person who can really stop this by vetoing the legislation. However, although the president is supposed to be above party politics, he does originally come from the Law and Justice Party. He was a member of the European Parliament for them. So it looks very unlikely that he will do that. Nonetheless, I think Donald Tusk, in issuing this open letter, has really tried to appeal not just to his better nature, but to really put him under the greatest degree of pressure internationally.
Now, as you say, the president comes from the same party, but does seem to be doing things to just slow the passage of this law.
Well, he somewhat unexpectedly demanded an amendment to one of the laws, because there are three separate laws that three separate bills that make up this package of judicial changes, and he said that in one of the cases he wants to see a 3/5 majority being necessary in Parliament to elect judges rather than a simple majority. And the idea behind that was to show that the Law and Justice, the governing party, has to have cross-party support in order to nominate judges. Now, this is arguably a step forward, but it's still it still ignores the fact that there are many other changes to the Polish judicial system which really bring it under political control. And the thing to remember is, in the with the Polish Parliament in its current composition, there is another authoritarian nationalist party who see eye to eye with Law and Justice on many issues, and together those two parties have 58% of MPs, so already very close to the 60% threshold necessary to elect judges. So it wasn't quite the spanner in the works that it initially looked like it might be from the president. Nonetheless, he would say that he has done something to distinguish himself from the government, which is absolutely necessary, because while 38% would have been enough to give the government a parliamentary majority, it's not enough for the president to be re-elected when the presidential elections come up. He needs to have wider support, not just Law and Justice voters.
That may not achieve anything in terms of stopping this law from going through, but there have been protests in Poland, people coming out on the streets against this. There is this pressure coming from other EU member states. Is that going to have an impact? Is that going to force a change of heart?
Well, at the moment, it doesn't appear to do so. I think the European Union, although, as I said, it looks likely that it won't be able to activate the formal sanctions against Poland in the form of Article 7 and the suspension of voting rights, it can make life quite uncomfortable for Poland within the EU. For example, although it probably can't suspend funds that have already been agreed, within the next couple of years, the next long-term EU budget will be negotiated, and the European Commission and other member states and to date, Poland has been a huge beneficiary of EU funds, which have helped it to modernise its economy and have helped Poland be the only European country that has enjoyed an unbroken record of growth, even through the financial crisis. So for the next 5 to 7 years, which is how long the EU budget lasts for, the European Commission can say, well, look, if you're not going to respect European values, why should you be the biggest net beneficiary of the budget? There are also a lot of political things that Poland wants the EU to do. It wants the EU to be more liberal when it comes to shale gas, for example. The EU can not to illustrate this is not a good way for the EU to work, of course, but the whole situation is suboptimal. But there are obviously things that the EU can do in areas that matter to Poland to essentially try and coerce it to change course domestically.
Now, Poland's prime minister has said that the victory of his party gives him a mandate to govern without other institutions getting in the way. But it's unusual for a prime minister, even one who has very specific ideas about the way the country should be run, to say that among the institutions he doesn't need to pay any attention to are the judiciary.
Well, exactly. And I think this touches on a fundamental point and an understanding of democracy. And I think this is a problem that's not just limited to Poland. We're seeing it in other countries. And it's the extent to which democracy means the popular will of the people, or indeed a plurality, not even a majority of public opinion, versus a more democratic system where you have checks and balances. And certainly in the eyes of Law and Justice, they would argue that because they have won the elections, that gives them a blank check to do to manage the country in whatever way they want. Now, in Poland, there is a provision that if you have a two-thirds majority in parliament, you can change the constitution. Law and Justice don't have a two-thirds majority, but what they are doing is they are passing ordinary legislation. They are ramming it through parliament. You have instances where a whole bill is from being tabled to being passed both by the lower house and then by the upper house within days for major pieces of legislation that change the functioning of the state, and that's just not a good way of pursuing democratic governance with very little scrutiny. As I mentioned earlier, the public broadcaster has been brought under the government's control, so they are guaranteed to give favourable coverage of whatever the government is doing. And it's an open question as to what that is. It might not be a dictatorship in the way that we understand it in the classical sense of what we had in Europe in the 1930s, but it's also clearly not a good democratic system where the constitution can be circumvented.
Pavel, thank you very much for your insight this evening. It's Pavel Siddiqui here in the studio. You're listening to Monocle 24. Well, next tonight, John McCain is one of those figures who seems to have always been around in American politics, a veteran senator who in 2008 challenged Barack Obama for the White House. Last night, his family revealed that he has a brain tumor discovered after surgery last week. It can be treated, but medical experts say it almost always returns. Well, Senator McCain is said to be considering his treatment options, but whatever happens next, he is likely to be absent from Washington at a vital time for the Republican Party and the nation. Well, on the line now is Monocle's New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker. Ed, let's deal first with how America's political leaders, past and present, have been reacting to John McCain's news.
Indeed. I mean, the I don't want to say tributes, but messages have been coming in from both sides of the political divide. You know, this is someone who you alluded to, who is highly respected in Washington. You know, this is someone who's been in congressional politics since 1982, 35 years first in the House of Representatives, and a sixth term senator for the state of Arizona. You know, he kind of has a strong independent streak, and so he's admired and on both sides, and often, in fact, reviled by some of the more conservative Republican factions. But he's someone who is highly respected for his record. And even going back before politics, he was kind of in the limelight in the 1960s when he was actually captured during the Vietnam War and tortured for around 5 years. So he's someone who's been in the national spotlight for a number of years. And actually, you may recall that Donald Trump had a dig at him back in 2015. In the summer of 2015, he attacked his war record, saying that basically he preferred people who didn't get caught. Just one example of Donald Trump shooting from the hip, as it were. That drew widespread condemnation from across the political board, which again goes to some extent of, you know, showing how well respected he is in Washington, D.C.
There are immediate political implications to John McCain being out of the capital for however long he may be, not least the current debate on healthcare reform.
Indeed. I mean, Mitch McConnell already delayed there being any sort of debate on the floor when John McCain was out. Originally, as you may recall, he was having treatment for a blood clot, above his left eye. And then that subsequently turned out to be something more serious. Now, he has been on social media today. He's been very upbeat, and he's saying that his sparring partners in Congress, in the Senate, need to watch out because he's going to be back soon. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen in terms of what treatment he's going to choose, and we don't know how long he's going to be out and if he's going to be returning to the Senate in the short term. So we're going to have to wait and see. This is obviously very new news. It was only released by his office and his family late on Wednesday night. So we'll have to wait and see as more information comes out when he might come back to the Senate. But he's a fighter, and he's obviously very, very involved in the issue of healthcare. And so I'm sure he'll want to return to the Senate as soon as possible.
The other role that he was fulfilling, in a way, was being a really important voice of restraint and opposition on the Trump administration from inside the Republican Party. And it's hard to think of anybody else with his profile or experience who would step up to take that role.
Well, indeed, he heads up the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he's been very outspoken about this issue of Russia. And he he considers Russia an adversary. I mean, in many ways, he's a reminder of kind of what old school Republicans are. He, as I said before, has an independent streak, but he definitely doesn't represent that sort of new breed of conservative. He's not super ideological. He's an old-fashioned conservative politician, but isn't as attached to some of that more extreme, one might say, ideology of this newer breed of Republican that's kind of come to the fore in more recent years. He's also been, in a way, a kind of unofficial opposition amongst the Republican ranks to Donald Trump. I mean, he still supported him in his run, although he kind of took a slightly back seat on that. But he's been prepared to kind of, in a way, break ranks with the rest of Republicans and voice criticism. Now, he's not the only one, actually. One of his longtime friends, another Southern senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, has also been another. I guess those two have been the two people leading this sort of opposition to Donald Trump and talking about issues such as Russia. So I expect, you know, Lindsey Graham's been talking to the press today. He's been making statements about his long-time friend, and I'm sure Lindsey Graham will continue that fight. But obviously, John McCain's presence in all senses will be missed while he's away from the Senate.
Monocle's New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker there. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Still to come, the citizen journalist who stood up in Raqqa, plus the best restaurants in the world. And in just a moment, the deteriorating state of relations between Germany and Turkey.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
So next to Germany, where the government has told its citizens that it is no longer safe to travel to Turkey. It's part of what ministers have called a significant reorientation of German policy towards Turkey, a move that follows the detention of another German citizen accused, like so many in Turkey, of terrorist activity. Well, joining me on the line now is Elizabeth Brohr, who's a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Elizabeth, this is not the first time that a German citizen has been detained on somewhat dubious charges in Turkey. There's a correspondent from Die Welt who's been in detention since February, but it seems like finally the government in Berlin has now had enough.
Yes, indeed. And today, Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel, who has been a great friend of Turkey in the past, essentially said, we've had enough. We're changing our foreign policy. And in practical terms, what that means is that the German government, for example, will no longer be guaranteeing German investments in Turkey. And it's also issued a warning to private citizens wishing to travel to Turkey. So that will impact tourism as well.
Now, Turkey obviously is not happy, accusing Germany of what it called diplomatic rudeness. But is this symbolic of a wider European anger at the increasingly authoritarian direction that Turkey's government is taking? Or is it just Germany does have specific links to Turkey, Germany does have a large Turkish population?
Yes, it does. And Germany is, you could say, Turkey's closest ally in Europe simply because of that large Turkish population. And in the past, it has been a very loyal friend to Turkey within NATO and within the EU as well, essentially supporting Turkey's accession talks to the EU. But those accession talks seem to be firmly on the shelf for now.
Now, it is quite a change from a year ago when Germany and other European nations were very keen on getting Turkish help to deal with the refugee crisis. And it seemed that some countries in Europe were willing to overlook the human rights abuses going on there in pursuit of that aim.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, Turkey is the crucial player when it comes to the refugee crisis. And it did agree to this deal that essentially saved Germany and you might say Austria as well and the rest of Northern Europe from a large-scale influx of asylum seekers. And for that reason, Germany and the rest of the EU were willing to overlook these human rights abuses. But when German human rights activists are detained, as was the case this week with the German gentleman, then it's hard to look the other way. Germany did have to do something.
Now, some politicians say that President Erdogan is building up a stockpile of what they call political hostages to try to force Germany to hand over these two Turkish generals who want to stay in Germany, who've been accused of being involved in the failed coup last year.
Yes, it's a very tricky situation for Germany. So in a country where you have separation of powers and courts rule in favor of particular asylum seekers, including a number of Turkish officers, there's little the government can do to overturn the court's decisions. And that doesn't seem to have the to be clear to the Turkish government. And so the Turkish government essentially wants to force the German government to return these officers. But that's easier said than done when the judiciary is independent of the executive branch of the government.
Now, the Turkish government doesn't seem terribly receptive to outside interference or criticism from other countries. So is there any prospect that things will change as a consequence of pressure coming from Germany?
I don't think so. And in fact, I think it would be counterproductive if we Western liberals keep telling Erdogan that he should stop his dictatorial or authoritarian tendencies. I don't think that will convince him. Now, what might convince him is if Western investments, especially German investments, decline or even dry up. If the economy, the Turkish economy, suffers as a result, he will have to change his tune.
As you say, political pressure doesn't seem to achieve anything. He does need that investment from other countries. But then at the same time, he doesn't seem to be able to control his anger because he's accused some big German companies of being allies of his political enemies.
Exactly, yes. He has accused, for example, employees of BASF, which is, as you know, a large German company, of being members of the Gulen movement and without offering any evidence. So, yes, it seems to be rather irrational, and you might even call it a witch hunt. But that being said, I don't think Germany lecturing Turkey will have any effect on his behavior. And in fact, that's something that the German politicians are very much aware of. They've been very diplomatic in their criticism of Turkey until this week when the human rights activist was detained on very dubious charges.
Elizabeth, thank you very much. That's Elizabeth Brough from the Atlantic Council. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, in 2014, a group of 17 Syrians began to document and share with the world the brutality of life under Islamic State control in Raqqa. That project, called Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently, was a landmark moment in citizen journalism. Well, now the filmmaker Matthew Heineman has delved into their stories for his new film, City of Ghosts. He spoke to Monocle's features editor, Chris Lord, about the legacy of the group's work.
The film began really as this exploration of the sort of media war, this information war between ISIS's slick propaganda on one side and RBSS's content on the other. As the film went on, it became much more than that for me. It became an immigrant story. It became a story of finding oneself in a new land. It became a story of rising nationalism in Europe. And then, you know, as you see quite vividly in the end of the film, it became also a story of trauma and the cumulative effects of trauma. And for me, these guys had been through more than any of us could ever truly imagine. You know, jailed and tortured by the Assad regime, jailed and tortured by ISIS, family members killed, colleagues killed, being forced to be on the run, living in safe houses, continuing to get death threats, even as we speak. But they carried themselves with the stoicism. And so it was important to me to try to sort of pierce beneath that stoicism and see the effects that all this trauma had had upon them. And so, you know, that was one of my goals, is to try to understand that.
You mentioned the media war there, and it's very true. You went throughout the film, we see ISIS's attempts to make what they were doing into almost a game. And you see that the sort of techniques that they used to attract people was to make it look like video games, what was happening there in Raqqa and elsewhere. And then couple that with, of course, as you mentioned, RBSS's own attempts to document what was going on, which was a little bit scratchier, a little bit more simple. Was there a need to kind of document this change in face of how occupations are, that the fact that so much now is about video, about multimedia, about how we understand conflicts and how we win conflicts is about how we control the media, do you think?
Totally. I mean, you know, this is sort of warfare in the new age, you know, 2017 warfare, and the way in which ISIS has waged this sort of battle online is as destructive as the battle that they've waged on the ground to some degree. And they've used these propaganda videos, they've used this media, they've used social media to do two things: to disseminate fear all across the world, and then to disseminate their ideology and export their ideology all across the world to attract followers. And clearly they've done that successfully as well. And I mean, look at what's happened in this country, in Manchester and Orlando and Paris and places all across the West. And as they lose ground, you know, as they've already lost Mosul, you know, there's a battle right now for Raqqa, which they most likely will lose in the next couple of months. You know, I think we're going to see, unfortunately, more and more attacks on the West as they resort more and more to their sort of guerrilla terrorism tactics.
You're a filmmaker yourself. Do you think the world, certainly here in the West, has grasped that media war yet? Have they got their head around how to challenge the narratives that are coming out of groups like ISIS, do you think?
Yes and no. You know, I think as I learned quite vividly in making this film, and, you know, as Aziz, one of our main characters, says in the end of the film, you know, they're fighting an idea. They're fighting an ideology. They're not fighting a military force. And again, this idea has been indoctrinated into a whole generation of children. It's been indoctrinated into people all across the world. And so we as a global community, we as governments, we as citizens, we as journalists need to figure out a way to combat this extremism, to combat this perversion of Islam, and to combat this, you know, this ideology. And I think the work of RBSS is one really important step in that direction.
You mentioned before about the fact that the tide is turning against ISIS in Raqqa and also in Mosul as well. When you talk to the RBSS team now, what do they say happens next?
You know, I think, unfortunately, you know, the name of the group is Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently. And I think, unfortunately, there's no happy ending anytime soon, and that Raqqa will continue to be slaughtered silently. I hope I'm wrong, but I think, you know, what most likely is going to happen is that, you know, they get rid of ISIS as they got rid of Assad during the revolution. Well, after they got rid of Assad, there was a vacuum of power, in walks ISIS. And, you know, I think there's a good chance that, you know, a new group walks in, fills this vacuum that's created after ISIS leaves, perhaps with a different name, perhaps with a different shirt. But I think, you know, we're not fixing the underlying cause of what's happening. We're just, you know, sort of trying to bomb away the issue, and that's not going to fix it.
Just want to ask you about, finally, about truth and reconciliation. I wonder about when we, you know, so much throughout this war in Syria has been a question of fact. Everybody claims that they've got a different version of the facts and what's going on there. And I wonder the work of RBSS, when you think about their legacy, when eventually there does become some sense of stability there, let's only hope that there will be that. Do you think that their dispatches, what they managed to collate in that period, could be used in some kind of truth and reconciliation to bring that city back together in the aftermath of some sort of stability again?
I'd like to think so. I'd hope so. You know, I think they were everyday citizens. You know, they were studying to be students and, sorry, their students studying to be lawyers and doctors and scientists. And, you know, they didn't want to take on this job. You know, this wasn't their sort of career path, but they were forced into it. And, you know, they decided that they wanted to become citizen journalists. And first to expose the atrocities of the Assad regime and then, of course, ISIS. And I think, you know, their work is going to be ever more important, you know, even if ISIS falls. And I think part of what the film is it's an homage to journalism. It's an homage to people fighting for and seeking the truth, especially in this world where truth seems to be malleable. Facts seem to be malleable. This era of, you know, quote-unquote fake news, this film is a celebration of individuals, again, risking their lives to expose the truth and to shed light on dark corners of the world. We would have no idea what's happening in Raqqa if it wasn't for these guys.
And that's Matthew Heineman, the director of City of Ghosts, in conversation there with Monocle's Chris Lord. We'll turn now to look ahead to this week's edition of The Menu, which will reveal the top five in the Monocle Restaurant Awards, our list of the best places in the world to eat. We, meanwhile, are off to Brazil, because this week's edition of the spin-off podcast, The Food Neighborhoods, heads to São Paulo's Centro District, a key destination for some of the country's best food. Our correspondent, Sheena Rossiter, joined the chef and food blogger, Silvia Silbagi, to go on a tour.
Eu acho que o centro de São Paulo ele precisa ser descoberto mais pelas pessoas.
Sylvia tells us that she brought us to the city center, the Central neighborhood, since it's an area that needs to be discovered more. And she chose to bring Sandra and I to the bakeries here in the center, since Brazilian breakfast, coffee and a simple piece of French bread, is what helps bring people together. Our first stop is the newly opened Mundo Pão do Olivet, located in Praça da República, a popular meeting point in central São Paulo. The bakery has been opened by French chef Olivet Anquier, a celebrity chef in his own right here in Brazil, and who's called the South American country home since the late 1970s.
Pão branco, clássico, para comer com manteiga e café com leite.
We go for the classic white crusty roll for a taste.
We're going to try a few things here. We're going to try just a typical bread, just plain white artisanal bread that was made here at Oliver. And also we're going to try a croissant. It's not a typical croissant. It's called a coração, a heart. And it's in the shape of a heart, but it's used with the same type of bread that you use for a croissant. And in the middle, there is a bit of cream. So it will be quite tasty. So Sandra here now is trying a little bit of the bread. Make sure you get a bit of butter on that. Is it good?
It's good. My first bite, I can tell it's quite good.
What does it kind of remind you of, like a bread that you taste more artisanal, kind of fresh from the oven, kind of something that you find in a farmhouse?
Well, the thing is that having a bread fresh like this, and having a bit of coffee as well, reminds me like my childhood. When we used to buy or get like a very fresh bread at bakery, and put some butter on it, and have some coffee and milk, It's a very traditional dish, I would say, in Brazil.
Here in central Sao Paulo, this is quite a lively place, especially around lunchtime, Monday to Friday. Although it's not really a residential area much anymore, with many of the buildings being abandoned and being part of a rejuvenation project that the city's new mayor, João Doria, has for the part of the city. It still is quite a lively place, as there's still a lot of businesses that operate in and around the area. So you can find everything on these streets as you walk through them during lunchtime, Monday to Friday. You can find people selling bootleg DVDs, for example, just on the sides of the street. You'll also find many people looking to buy and sell gold. Or, as we just heard, you can find people that are trying to try out for their own little street version of X Factor, if you will. Because of all this life here in the city center, especially during the weekdays, Monday to Friday around lunchtime, that's where you've seen this real growth of bakeries here. People just rather need quick places where they can stop and get a coffee on their coffee break, or just have a quick croissant or a loaf of bread, just for a little snack between the busy points of the day. We're arriving here at stop 2, Casa Matilde, or Matilde's House, which is a traditional Portuguese bakery that's existed since 1850. Have you ever been here, Sandro?
No, I have not. In fact, I was surprised that it was right here, São Bento Street. I used to pass by every single day, and I never noticed, no joke, I never noticed this amazing, like, doceria tradicional portuguesa. It must be in this building here, it must be new. Let's check it out, because I would notice. Let's check it out.
Aqui tem que comer o pastel de nata.
Você gosta, né, o pastel de Belém?
Adoro.
É uma delícia, né?
So here it almost looks like a cafeteria in a way, where you have the long line, long window, and just all the sweets and sandwiches are lined up here in a window, and you can just pop behind and just take your picking, and then there's an upstairs where we're going to sit down and eat. So here at Casa Matilde, the doceria portuguesa, or basically which translates to the sweet shop, the Portuguese sweet shop, as you guessed it, their specialty is Portuguese sweets. By far, they're definitely popular here in Brazil. You can get everything from the traditional pastel de Santa Clara to certain pastries that features nuts. But of course, by far, the most popular one that we're going to try right now is called the pastel de nata, which is kind of a cream pastry. Can you tell us, Sandro, what it is and what it tastes like?
Pastel de Belém, porque é da cidade de Belém.
Okay.
Mas é pastel de nata de Belém.
I did.
Entendeu?
In Brazil, in São Paulo, and among people I know, it's known as pastel de Belém. However, it's made, originally made in Belém, Portugal, and it's called actually pastel de nata. And I actually got to learn these things not long ago. And because apparently if you ask any Portuguese about pastel de Belém, they're gonna tell you, go to Portugal, in Belém, find it there. Anyway, it's called pastel de nata.
E eles vieram aqui para o Brasil, eles trouxeram funcionários portugueses para fazer.
So Silvia just exposed the secret of Casa Matilde, why the Portuguese sweets are so good. Because they brought workers from Portugal to specially make some of these desserts here.
And that was Molecule's Sheena Rossiter reporting from Sao Paulo's Centro neighborhood. For more food and drink stories and to find out the winners of this year's Molecule Restaurant Awards, you can tune into the menu when it premieres tomorrow, Friday, at 1900 London time here on Molecule 24 and any time after that online. Coming up, how do you replace a TV legend? And in just a moment, the biggest stories from across Asia. Do stay with us.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world. Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
Well, it's time now to take a look at some of the big stories from across Asia. And my guest in the studio this evening, the former British ambassador to North Korea and other fine locations, John Everard. John, thank you very much for coming in this evening. We begin with... it's not really that recent a story, is it? It's that humans arrived in Australia far, far earlier than we thought they did.
Yes, that's right. A find near Kakadu National Park in Australia, so about 300 kilometres east of the fine city of Darwin, with archaeologists using new techniques have dug down through a previous dig and have established that, in fact, the human artefacts there date to about 18,000 years before people thought they did, which effectively rewrites Australian prehistory. 65,000 years ago, they must have arrived in Australia, and 65,000 years ago, they were already not just present, they were making some really quite fine examples of ochre art, the typical Aboriginal kind, and had quite advanced technology. They found what they believe is the world's oldest flint axe head, with a very finely cut groove where you put the haft and glue it in with resin. So these people were quite sophisticated. This, of course, fits into a wider picture that we're building up. Not long ago, everybody thought that there was just one big migration out of Africa around 60,000 years ago, probably caused by environmental problems in Africa, though no one's entirely sure. And most of the genes that you and I carry come from that migration. But just over the last couple of years, people have realised that things aren't that simple. Back in September, they found teeth, human teeth, in Israel that dated back to 90,000 years, so a long time before the supposed migration. And there are some finds in the Middle East that they think may be 100,000 years old, though they're a bit wobbly on the dating. It's looking as if, in fact, humanity came out of Africa, sure, but came out of Africa in more waves than we thought. And the different waves reached different extremities. Obviously, going into Israel is one proposition. Having a wave of migration that takes you as far as Australia is quite something. I mean, obviously, you don't go that far just for the fun of it.
How did they get there?
They walked.
It's hard enough to get there as it is.
Well, that's right, yes. They didn't have to deal with the Australian visa restrictions at the time, of course. But they walked. At the time, there was a land bridge linking Australia with Southeast Asia. So it was a very long walk, but you could do the whole thing over land. And in any case, we believe that these people had some naval technology, which rather grannies say, which means they could build canoes. But yes, it was a long way. And nobody's entirely sure yet why they went that far. You can understand being forced out of Africa. Environmental change means that your hunting grounds are no longer feeding your people, so you have to move on. But moving as far as Australia, I mean, what's driving these people? The find raises all kinds of really quite intriguing questions to which the scientists have yet to find proper answers.
It is absolutely fascinating, isn't it? Less good news coming out of trade talks between the US and China.
Yes, it looks like a bit of a dialogue of the deaf. The comprehensive economic dialogue, as it's rather grandly called, between the United States and China had a session on Wednesday, which sort of wrapped up without very much at all. I mean, nobody was thinking that the US and China were going to solve all their trade issues in one fell swoop, if only. But the two sides had actually scheduled press conferences suggesting that they thought they were going to have something to say, which were cancelled. And the general, the body language is that the differences between the two sides are still immense. It's not difficult to guess what the real rub points are, and steel will be one of the big ones, a neuralgic point in China, where millions of people depend on the steel industry, and of course also in the United States, where President Trump has said quite explicitly that he believes that the Chinese are dumping and that they are therefore destroying the US steel industry.
Donald Trump has going, certainly on the campaign trail, really did go after China, for, as you say, for dumping steel, said he was going to revive America's steel industry, put coal miners back to work. But these are two economies at fundamentally different points. China is the country that is now in the position to go around dumping steel on markets. The US can't compete. And yet he does seem to be going at trade goals that don't necessarily seem to be in his country's best interests.
Whether they're in his country's best interest, we'd need a very long interview to discuss. But can the US compete? The point that the Americans make is that the reason that the Chinese are able to dump is unfair state interference in the state sector, that the Chinese steel sector, is artificially bloated by the Chinese government. And it is absolutely enormous. I mean, it's not just that China produces more steel than the United States. China produces more steel than the rest of the world put together. And despite lots of promises, Chinese steel output is actually still rising. So where is all the steel going to go? Naturally, American steel producers feel that they're being cut out and unfairly treated. You can understand their point.
To Hong Kong next, and memorials for Liu Xiaobo.
That's right. As any Chinese will tell you, the spirit of the recently deceased will come back to their home 7 days after they die to bid a final farewell to their relatives and to their loved ones. And so 7 days after Liu Xiaobo passed away, his spirit doubtless came back to his home. And the moment was marked in Hong Kong by a memorial in Tamar Park and by memorial acts in all kinds of places, focusing on an empty chair. The empty chair, of course, symbolising the empty chair at the Nobel Prize ceremony, which he was forbidden to attend by the Chinese Communist government. And also by the sea. The sea because the authorities, the Chinese authorities, insisted that his ashes be scattered at sea. Liu Xiaobo supporters believe this was so that there could be no shrine which they could use as a kind of centre of opposition to the government. It's not just physical memorials. The internet has seen dozens and dozens of special memes, special images of empty chairs by the seaside from all over the place in honour of Liu Xiaobo, including, bravely, from mainland China itself, where people close to the family, people showing any kind of mourning, are still getting into trouble. There's one rather bizarre story of a family friend who was visited by her local policeman, given two cartons of cigarettes and a watermelon, and told to stay at home, presumably munching watermelon, smoking cigarettes. But this is going on all across China.
And as you mentioned, those online tributes, people were having to be very creative because there were these algorithms that were looking for anything that could be interpreted as talking about this.
Yes.
And shutting it down immediately. And so hence things like empty chairs and references. I know lots of people reference this to somebody left today and this kind of thing.
Yes, that's right. The algorithms are quite effective at picking up text. So you have to be very careful what you write. They are much less effective at picking up subversive images. Still now, they have to be checked out by human beings, and the process is much slower, hence the attraction of photographs of empty chairs by the seaside.
Should you bump into the Indian Prime Minister in the next few weeks, don't give him any flowers.
No, that's right. A special instruction has gone out from what in rather 1984 speak is called the competent authority, saying that if you are receiving Prime Minister Modi in India on his official visit, no flowers, please, because flowers just wither and die. Instead, a book or a bit of Indian homespun. Remember, this was one of Gandhi's great themes, the homespun, the hand-woven textiles of India, which Prime Minister Narendra Modi has embraced and suggested that a handkerchief or a nice bit of cloth rather than a flower would be a more appropriate gesture. Of course, cloth lasts a lot longer than flowers, as do books, which is the other thing that he suggested. I must say, it leaves me wondering if he actually is going to get a book from every place he visits. And as Prime Minister,
where's he going to read them?
Where's he going to read them? Exactly.
I'm not Prime Minister of India. I don't have time to read any of the books that I've got at home.
Well, no, that's right. I mean, I've done jobs where people have given me lots of books in just this kind of circumstance. I've read a few of them, but I mean, I'll be sort of very, very old indeed by the time I get to the end.
And you have to think. I mean, I'm in no position to be offering advice to the Prime Minister of India. It's fair to say that he's done better with his life than I have with mine. But all I would say is that the more books you leave on a shelf staring at you as a reminder of your utter failure to read them, the worse you feel about yourself.
Yes, that's right. It's human nature, isn't it, that you tend to focus more on the books you haven't read than saving the books you have. Maybe he's not going to put them on a shelf in full view. Maybe he's going to establish a kind of Narendra Modi memorial library when he finally leaves office.
Just lastly, the cloth thing is interesting. As you say, it evokes Gandhi. He's not trying to style himself after Gandhi, is he?
No, I don't think there's that. I think it's more just picking up what's been a recurrent theme of Indian politics, the importance of supporting handicrafts and Indian traditions in the face of mass industrialisation. I think that's that'll be seen.
John, thanks very much. John Everard there, looking through some of the big news stories of the last 24 hours from across Asia. Now, for almost 30 years, Peter Mansbridge has been, in many ways, the voice of Canada, the anchor of the CBC's main news programme, The National. He stood down from that role at the beginning of this month. And this creates a problem that television networks the world over have had to wrestle with. When someone has occupied so important a chair for so long, how do you go about replacing them? Well, the TV critic John Doyle has been writing about those potential replacements of the Globe and Mail, and he joins me on the line now. John, for those who don't know him, tell us a little bit about Peter Mansbridge and the programme he presented.
Well, as you said in your introduction, yes, Peter Mansbridge was certainly the voice, the face of, if not Canada, then certainly the CBC, our public broadcaster, for decades. He came into the business in an odd way. This is part of the legend surrounding Mansbridge. He was working at the airport, a tiny airport in Churchill, Manitoba, and as part of his duties, he was asked to make some announcements about, you know, delayed flights, lost luggage, that sort of thing. A producer from CBC Radio heard him, liked the voice, and offered him a job at CBC Radio in Manitoba, which he took, and that was the start of a career that led to reporting from around the world, reporting from Ottawa, and eventually anchoring The National on CBC for a very long time.
Now, you have in some of your columns in the past called him Pastor Mansbridge. Is it fair to say you're not necessarily a fan?
Oh, I am a fan. You know, I think I decided to call him Pastor because he had that gravitas about him that suggested somebody delivering the Sunday sermon. He took it in good spirit. I never heard from him to complain about being called Pastor, and it has become part of the Globe and Mail style, I think, in describing Mansbridge. He did have a gravitas. He was particularly good in times of national crisis, breaking news, when an anchor is obliged to go on the air and be on the air for hours, process a lot of information, ask questions on the fly of reporters in the field. He was very good at that. And he will be very difficult to replace.
And that is the next issue now that is occupying the minds of a lot of people in Canada, isn't it? Of who is going to take over full time?
Well, I was actually a bit taken aback by the amount of mail I was getting on this issue. There is something odd about the way all of this has evolved, which probably has more to do with CBC politics than anything else. But Mansbridge announced he was leaving last September, didn't leave until July 1st, and it seems only now that the broadcaster is actually concentrating on auditioning candidates and putting people on the air who might replace Mansbridge or be part of a sort of a replacement team for Mansbridge, which is one of the interesting possible outcomes of all of this, is that there won't be a single anchor. There will probably be a team. It will probably be two or three people, one or two of them anchoring from different parts of the country.
It is interesting in a time of rolling news and constant updates online that it's still a matter of huge importance to a lot of people who presents one nightly news program.
It is, yes, it is kind of extraordinary because the conventional wisdom is that, first of all, the younger generation is kind of repulsed by the idea that a single middle-aged male voice of authority delivers the summary of the day's news and appears on television to sort of calm and reassure the nation in times of crisis. The conventional wisdom is that, you know, it's not necessary to do this anymore, but the interest in who will replace Mansbridge certainly underlines the fact that people, by impulse, do look to one person to deliver the day's news, and that isn't going to change anytime soon.
Now, you see that in Britain, that at times of crisis or major news events, the BBC gets 10 times as many viewers as anybody else, no matter what work or effort everybody else puts in. People just gravitate back to the state broadcaster. Is it a similar thing in Canada?
Yes, it is. There is, that's an interesting point because it does undermine the idea that, you know, the day of the news anchor is either dying or is gone. Because yes, in times of crisis, big national breaking stories, it's like there's this magnetic pull towards the state broadcaster, or certainly the big broadcaster, as the voice of authority on what is actually happening. And I suppose it means that in times when people are more than curious, sometimes they're disturbed or frightened by say, a terrorist attack, something along those lines, they are drawn to the national broadcaster for coverage of events. And that, I think, underlines the importance of who or what will replace Mansbridge here in Canada.
And indeed, some people have argued it is that very explosion of information, of sources of information, that has made those mediated newscasts more important, because people feel a bit overwhelmed and want somebody to do all the work for them, effectively, and present them with a summary of the day.
That's very true. I think if you watch, certainly in this part of the world, if you watch all news channels like CNN or Fox or MSNBC, you could get a severe headache from the amount of news that is being thrown at you, from the amount of very shallow punditry that is put on the air, and you kind of long for somebody to tell you like a straight narrative about what is actually happening, what is true, and what is simply opinion or rumor. That is the way things work. I think it's a human impulse to want to sort of father or mother figure to sort of explain things to you and reassure you.
Just briefly, you've gone through in your article a lot of the sort of runners and riders. Do you have a favorite possible permanent replacement?
Oh, I think whether it's going to be one person or two or three people, with the third sort of rotating, the strongest candidate is Ian Hannah-Mansing, who is currently based at CBC in Vancouver and has plenty of experience on the CBC's All News channel.
Well, we'll have to watch with interest to see if he makes it. Sorry to cut you short there, John Doyle, though. Thank you very much for joining us. That is it for this edition of The Monocle Daily. It was produced by Ben Ryland. Our researchers are Paige Reynolds and Hester Underhill, and our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. The Globalist here 8 hours from now, 7 a.m. London time, and The Monocle Daily returns at 2200 in London tomorrow. From me, Paul Osborne, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.